This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 80, for November 18, 2010, live from L.A. Welcome live from Los Angeles, from the Sofitel Hotel in L.A. itself. This is Autoline After Hours. We also have to thank our sponsors here. Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, get used to more. The all-new Chevrolet Cruze. And Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com. And thanks, everybody, for joining us here, live here in Los Angeles. We've moved the show here for today because of the Los Angeles Auto Show. And joining us tonight, Peter DeLorenzo wasn't able to make it. He had business reasons that he wasn't able to make the show. But since we didn't have that DeLorenzo, we brought in another DeLorenzo. We've got Matt DeLorenzo, the editor-in-chief of Road and Track Magazine. Great having you here.
Great to be here, John.
We also have Chelsea Sexton. She's an advocate, and we're going to find out an advocate for just what. But it's great to have Chelsea on the show, too, and we'll learn more about you, and our viewers will. And then some of you are going to recognize Charlie Vogelheim because he was on the show, what was that, a month ago or something?
It seems like a lifetime, but it was very memorable.
And, of course, Charlie is the executive editor at IntelliChoice.
So great to be here.
And bring us up to speed again. What is IntelliChoice?
IntelliChoice does cost of ownership. So we study all of the costs that you incur after you buy the car. So maybe you're looking at one car or another, and one is cheaper to buy, but which one is really cheaper to own? So we combine all of the data on residual value, insurance, maintenance, repairs, fuel utilization, and then we give you a better idea. And that's we want to talk to Chelsea about that a little bit because a large part of that has to do with alternative fuels because what's the real cost of ownership of these new power plants that we see springing up?
Well, that's a good segue because Chelsea is an advocate for electric cars,
plug-in hybrids.
Yep. So we got to tell people that I think most people in this country would know you because you were heavily featured in Who Killed the Electric Car?
A little bit.
And I hear you're going to be in The Revenge of the Electric Car as well?
You know, I don't know yet. I'm a consulting producer.
You might be on the cutting room floor.
I might be.
So...
But we are coming out with Revenge of the Electric Car next spring, loosely covering some of the efforts to bring plug-in cars back to the roads of America.
And you're driving a Chevrolet Volt right now.
I'm driving a Volt. I've had it for about a week as part of an advisory program with General Motors. There's 16 of us nationwide, and we all get to put them through their paces and give very honest feedback. And obviously, I'm known for my candor, and that's exactly what they want, and I'm happy to deliver.
The Nissan Leaf?
I don't have one of those in my driveway, but I've driven it a few times. It's a good little car.
Okay, Volt versus Leaf, where do you fall down?
Volt's a better driving experience. Leaf has the better geeky user interface for the people that want that stuff.
Okay.
And again, all electric. I was just in the lobby when she drove up, and it was so fun. That was the first time, again, being in L.A. We've gotten a chance to drive the car, and I had just driven it when I was on the show last time to actually be there and see a Volt turn the corner on the driveway and come on in and go, wait a second, I know that car.
Was it on electric power or gasoline?
Electric power.
All right. Yeah. So, Matt, what do you make of all the electric cars? I'm sure you've driven them, too.
Well, yeah, we just got a Leaf in, and we're going to test it tomorrow at El Toro. So we're going to run it through the usual battery of 0 to 60, quarter mile, skid pad, all that other stuff. They're good. I mean, I think there's going to be many solutions to transportation needs. And you're going to have hybrids. You're going to have pure electrics for city cars or other uses. So we welcome them. You know, it's great. All the diversity it really makes it interesting out there. The technology's interesting.
Yeah. So we're being drowned out by it. Sounds like a helicopter taking off.
My driver, I told him to go ahead and put it out in the back. This is going to take a little while. So I hate it when he just leaves it idling there because, again, fuel costs and everything like that.
Oh, it's Bob Lutz crashing the show.
Bob Lutz is just stopping by. I've got to point out, and just for those of you that aren't local, because you said it so matter-of-factly when he says we're going to take it out to El Toro, that's the former Marine Air Base that's down in Southern California where these guys do a lot of their testing because, again, it's at the air base. It's used for automotive testing.
And that's where the new Top Gear show, they do all their testing there, and they took one of the hangars and they've converted it into their studio. So they're following the Brit format exactly, and they're going to have a live in-studio audience, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
So,
So you've all been down at the LA show, I'm sure, over the last couple of days. Reactions, thoughts? What stands out?
Well, I get very excited. I'll tell you the thing that will stand out. Go park that in the back.
Everybody wait to the car.
Yeah, really. You know, first of all, it's the whole approach to it. Having, you know, been in the industry 25 years now and watched that show, now that it's moved to November, used to go toe-to-toe with the Detroit Auto Show, as we all know.
And Christmas and New Year's.
Christmas and New Year's. And that the town of Los Angeles, that downtown area, has gotten its act together. It's been much more embracing the whole event from a day or two before. I mean, we had things happening on Monday night all the way through. Now we're on Thursday, even right. Some things happening tomorrow. In the evening, in the morning, and so that part of it, I think, is one of the changes that we've seen. Just the whole production of the auto show, making it a week-long event, you know, obviously incorporating the stars and some other things, which are, you know, whatever. But it's just about embracing Los Angeles, you know, bringing it more into L.A.
It's the best L.A. auto show I've ever been
to, by far. It's the best one they've had this year so far.
Yeah.
Yeah, there seems to be a little bit more energy, and, you know, I think a lot of the companies have been through the worst part of it, so their operations are pared down, so they actually can make money at the volumes that they're selling and building cars. So there's been a lot more optimism. There's more optimism here. There's more optimism at SEMA this year. So, you know, whether or not the public is ready to buy all these cars, I don't know, but at least the manufacturers seem to be a more upbeat.
Well, the big difference is, you know, especially with the Detroit 3, is they're making money at abysmally low sales levels. And so if they can do that now, imagine what can happen when the economy picks up.
Right.
But the big news, I think, really is now they can spend money, and it's not just the three Detroit ones, too. We're seeing the Europeans here in a big way. And the quality of the displays is a whole lot better than it used to be, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
A lot of it was a little bit better than cars on a rug, you know.
Cars and carpet, we used
barely,
to say.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I remember, was it last year, the year before last, when Chrysler was going through all the stuff, and basically they didn't even have the lights on.
No, they hadn't bought the overhead lights. And unfortunately, they were right next to Audi, which was at that point featuring all white cars, very well lit. And then so your eyes actually had to adjust. And as you walked into Chrysler, it was darkness
a little bit.
Well, there was nobody there. There wasn't even the guys with the feather duster. Dusting the cars off. There was no one there.
If there's no light on them.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, you mentioned the domestics, and I'd love to jump on that because part of the story I thought was, you know, Dodge and Chrysler presenting vehicles here because so many have asked us, what do you think? Are they going to make it? We haven't seen. And then they kept saying, be patient. We haven't shown you what we're working on. So finally, they're starting to reveal the vehicles that are coming out.
They revealed 8 of them in L.A. So I think that says something for the L.A. show that here's a Detroit-based company using the L.A. show as its big splash.
They couldn't wait. And I mean, we had on the one side some of the tried and true from the minivan, to the new Fiat Cinquecento, the Fiat 500, that, again, part of the greater family. Truly, you know, I think it'll be an interesting car here in L.A. as any of the Metro units. But so there were some great things to talk about there. So.
Yeah.
And then Green Car Journal chose the Chevrolet Volt as its Green Car Journal Car of the Year. And then what?
Automobile.
And Motor Trend.
It was the award car of the year. Yeah.
So why?
IPO. I mean, they had a bad week. You know?
Right.
They had a big week, but I mean, where's the Nissan Leaf in all this? I would have thought at least it would have split something there.
Yeah, I would like to say, again, I'm so anxious for these cars to be on the road. I'm so anxious to see really what's it like. How much does the plug-in affect the grid? Does it, you know, do people use it? How far are they really going? And, you know, when we saw the Leaf at the New York show back in the spring, it was, well, why are you speaking about it? Well, you know what? It's getting the mass market electric car out there. Right. We already mentioned that you were involved with the EV1 back in the day, but, you know, again, the volume numbers were relatively small. Until we see everybody driving them, we really can't comment on what effect it's going to have.
Oh, no question. I mean, until consumers have the option to buy these cars and get to pick and choose. I mean, we joke because a few years ago we were trying to get one automaker to make one plug-in car, and now we're going, do we get a Leaf? Do we get a Volt? Do we get an iMEV? You know, what luxury?
And Prius plug-in here as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, I mean, the number of unveilings that had a plug.
Chelsea, I was wondering what you made of Koda and Fisker.
And explain a little bit, because a lot of people don't know what Koda is.
Well, both Koda and Fisker are entrepreneurial plug-in companies. Koda is based in Santa Monica, pure electric car, 100, 120 miles. Their big news basically in the last few weeks is that they have replaced their CEO. They have gotten rid of their VP of sales and marketing, which I think says a lot about how they were doing in terms of sales and production, and they moved their launch from next month to late next year. So obviously there's a whole lot of stuff for them to get past. You know, I really like their new CEO, and I think if anyone can make the public believe in them again, it's this guy. Whether it's too little too late remains to be seen.
I think if Coda had been here 3 to 5 years ago, I'd say, brilliant, you guys have a chance.
Heck, but 6 months ahead. But yeah. Now, I mean, it's the car's 12 grand more than a Leaf by a company no one's heard of, with Chinese product that isn't proven that the public will accept here no matter what propels it. I mean, they have a lot of hurdles to get through, and it's not the most attractive vehicle out there either.
Right.
You know, it's got some challenges there. Fisker, on the other hand, wildly sexy car from a known designer. Propulsion system also not quite as trusted, but their funny thing is no one has driven the car. It's been nothing but a static display at an auto show for years. And, you know, Henrik Fisker stands behind, I don't care what anybody thinks of my car or my company until next year when I put it out there and anyone can write whatever they want, and I don't care if y'all see me as vaporware. Okay, well, that's a fair position, but I'm not sure it'll work out in the end.
Right. Well, you know, if the car turns out to be really well done, he's got a chance.
And well-priced, again,
right.
So.
Right. But, you know, once you get these big car companies, the Nissans, the General Motors, the Fords,
Mercedes.
The Toyotas, the Mercedes, boy, watch out, because they don't mess around.
Right. But
they
we have right. given $500 million to Henrik.
To Fisker.
Right.
We have.
We,
right.
the taxpayer.
So,
yes,
there, yes we...
It wasn't
yeah,
just the four of us. Yeah. I want to be clear.
We passed the hat and we dug in the couch cushions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the stakes are much higher for that company than any of the others.
I just think that they had a window of opportunity, and I think it's closing on them. Because I think once, and I think the Volt is particularly an important car because it showed that the manufacturers do know how to get the technology and get it out on the road when they say it's going to get out on the road, rather than this, well, we'll have it out next year. And then next year comes along, and they say, well, it'll be next year after that.
Like
after
BYD.
That.
BYD was supposed to have their car on sale this month, right? That's what they announced.
And so, you know, it's going to be difficult for them to compete. And, you know, and there's two things. One, they're taking on these plants. You know, they're going to, Fisker's going to have Wilmington, and they're using NUMMI up there for Tesla.
But they're building them in Finland right now, right? Isn't that?
Well, that'll be the, that'll be the, yeah, but the, but then the smaller car, the Project Nina will be done in Wilmington. And that's all well and good, but that's a lot of cost, and that's a lot of startup. On the back end of it, the sales and distribution, I don't think they've even thought that far yet. And that's a very expensive
Well, I will
prospect,
argue that they
so.
Have. I mean, they've had Dick Doolin involved, and he's been putting together dealer bodies. So they're certainly looking at that. The one that we need to compare the Fisker to is the Tesla. And again, similar in size and shape, slightly different in that Tesla's going to be all electric, where Fisker's going to have an internal combustion engine on board.
But see, Tesla's bringing technology to the party.
Right.
Fisker's just buying technology.
Right.
And that's where, you know, so Tesla's got Toyota investing in it. And who was it just?
Panasonic.
Panasonic invested in it. Volkswagen hired.
Daimler, I think they're
Daimler
also.
Was
Daimler's
first.
Got some money in the game there, too. So I think Tesla's, you know, they've got something to bring to the party.
Right. Well, and at the
well,
same time.
Well, what is it, though?
Well, it's using those 18650 laptop batteries and figuring out how to manage how many cells are in that thing. I bet you can quote it off the top of your head. Because I can't remember. There's a bunch of cells.
There's a lot of cells.
I think that's the correct term.
Yes.
A bunch of cells,
yeah,
right.
Several bunches.
So they figured out through a guy named Martin Eberhard. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who invented, hey, here's the software to monitor all these cells and make sure they don't overheat or are properly charged and blah, 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 blah. Now Volkswagen's hired him, and he's wiring up a bunch of laptop batteries for Volkswagen to play around
right.
with.
Yeah.
So where do you think this is all going to go? Laptop batteries or purpose-built car batteries?
You know, I still shake out on the side of mostly purpose-built.
Why?
Because the auto industry's comfortable with it. Yeah,
that's
most
a good
of the majors are still too skittish over something like laptop batteries. I frankly was a little surprised when with all the things that Daimler could have taken from Tesla, they took their batteries.
Yeah.
You know, Toyota's taken the whole propulsion system, which makes more sense on some levels. So, you know, I think we'll see some experimentation in both sides, and there's advantages to both. But, you know, the incumbent industry is pretty comfy with their resident suppliers.
But see, that technology is state of the art now. And if there's some new state of the art that comes along, then all bets are off as far as Tesla's concerned. Because, you know, you look at the Leaf and Nissan, they're doing the laminate, you know.
Prismatic, as they call it. The flat batteries is what I call them, not the round batteries.
And I think kind of that's where it may settle out. And if that happens and that becomes the industry standard, then where does that leave Tesla?
Well, Tesla's talking about, again, we had a long conversation with Franz, the designer from Mazda that moved to Tesla a little while ago. He was saying that they're going to have their batteries are going to be able to swap out in a matter of moments. And that just means that maybe the packaging can change. And, you know, the size and shape will be the same. And again, whether there's a different chemical element, metal used or something like that. And that's kind of what's unnerving to a lot of the consumers is what's the next battery or what is it going to be from nickel metal hydride to some exotic material. And I think, you know, GM, as you talk about, it was, you know, a year or so ago ahead of the Volt coming to market that we weren't really sure what the battery was going to be. And they had some breakthrough in terms of developing the battery, and it all did come together to their benefit to release the car on time.
So what else? What else was at the show that caught your guys' eyes?
There are a couple of interesting concepts. The Nissan Elude was kind of interesting. You know, nice.
Describe that a little bit, because typically on the show we can bring pictures in, but we should be talking about we're pioneering new technology. Yeah. You guys see that laptop or a backpack that's sitting on a table? That is literally a satellite truck in a backpack. So we're streaming this out via cellular phone cards. This isn't going out via Wi-Fi anymore. But it's all real cool technology, but we can't roll in pictures. So that's a long way of saying, describe this car a little bit for the viewer.
Roll quarters over there. They keep having to drop into the payphone, by the way. Yeah. Could you make it quick?
Exactly. The Elude is a sort of an Altima-sized sedan. You know, it's doing more of a styling study. It is a hybrid. It has suicide doors. It was just more of a pure concept, which is kind of a departure because most of the concepts we've seen over the past few years
are almost production ready.
Exactly. Yeah. And the same thing over on the Mazda stand, the Shinari, is a pure design exercise, kind of pointing the direction where Mazda's design's going to go. They're going to get away from the Nagare, the flowing shapes.
Of course, this they changed designers.
Exactly. And this designer is the son of the guy who did the original RX-7. Hmm. And he did the RX-8. And his whole thing is that he wants crisper lines. He wants a car that looks like a crouched animal ready to pounce. It's really a beautiful car.
That was a really pretty car.
Yeah, and it was interesting is that they showed it to us before the Paris show, didn't take it to Paris, and Los Angeles is the first place that it's been shown publicly. Yeah. So it was a nice concept.
And then they introduced the Mazda 5, which, again, nice car, but it had the old design elements to it.
Yeah.
And again, the flow in to some people, it's just more crease lines and things like that, where the concept car was much more
clean.
Much smoother and clean.
Yeah.
Because the old design was done by Franz von Holzhausen, who you mentioned
Tesla,
before, who's
now
at Tesla. Exactly.
Right. And it was good. I mean, I think, I applaud Mazda for going in a very distinct direction because to a certain extent, you know, they need to stand out just a little bit and where they are. And they created lines, not unlike the way Cadillac made more of a bold design statement when they went to the origami, the folded line look that they've had for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, the Cadillac.
Yeah, the ULC.
Had a small car that had some neat design elements to it.
A-class size car.
A-class car. And you're looking at it and you're thinking, on the one hand, you argue that, you know, if people are going to go to a smaller car and they want luxury in it, then Cadillac should make one. On the other hand, you have to redefine luxury because to some, luxury is not small. I mean, it has to be larger. Now, hey, I got caught up in that argument years ago when I would have said, there's no such thing as a luxury SUV.
Right.
And it's like, wait a second, that's where Cadillac makes
most of their money now.
So, okay. Yeah. So obviously there's elements of that, you know, again, we change, but then you have to redefine the definition. But neat doors on that one.
They were on these scissor doors.
Yeah, but more than that, it was on a rod that actually came out away from the car and then bent up and then flattened so that you could open them in a garage situation and not have them hit the roof and such. So
I like the design a whole lot. It's not manufacturable, I don't think, but as a design study, it was good. And if you look at, say, like the Mercedes A-Class, this thing, to my eye, looked way better than anything Mercedes has proposed in a small size.
Yeah. Did you see the car? Or did you?
I didn't. I was playing with EVs all day.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
If it wasn't electric.
There were so many unveiled.
Yeah. Well, there were a lot of them.
But speaking of Mercedes, they did show their F-cell, right?
Yes.
Their fuel cell car. So do you have any hope for fuel cells?
You know, they have a tough road. I mean, as a geek, they're impressive technology, but the infrastructure and the economics are still so tough. So
right. There's where do you get your hydrogen?
Where do you get your hydrogen? You know, the energy used to make it, how much the vehicles still cost. You know, all of those things are still really, really major hurdles. And so it doesn't mean they're not going to get there.
Right.
But even Honda, the last holdout on the plug-in world, finally unveiled a Pure EV at this show and showed a concept chassis for a plug-in hybrid. They're still firmly in the Clarity fuel cell, but even they have finally conceded that in the meantime, they've got to do something with a plug on it.
But wasn't that because their prior CEO said, hey, we can't make a business case for electrics. We're not even going to go down that road. He retired and bang, they spun on a dime and now they've got an electric out.
Yeah, but I think it's more that they were the last company and everyone was looking at them going, okay, come on, you know.
Well, I'll give them credit. You know, so many of us for years have described Honda as an engine company that happened to build cars.
Right.
So, and they did such a competent job with their engines in terms of efficiency and even in terms of, you know, from pollution.
Oh, sure. They're clean cars. Their gas cars are good.
So, yeah, and that was the Fit,
Fit
platform, which is a global platform for them. And again, it's a it probably makes sense that they could do that. But
right.
When talking to them, they really didn't change much. You know, a lot of the things with an electric car is you get this opportunity to really change the design elements. Like the Tesla, for instance, has all this incredible storage because they have it in the front and the back because there isn't an engine occupying up there. They can do the flat floor. But, you know, when you're just switching over a Fit. And the other thing that was interesting about that is, you know, some of the times people want an electric car that really looks different.
You
can identify it as such. A Leaf is such, and a Volt, same thing. But a Fit, then you have to almost read, is that the regular Fit or the electric Fit? So it's interesting. I mean, there are different ways to do it. But we found, or you can jump in on this, that it seems like because some of the people are getting the alternative fuels want to show everybody that they're in alternative fuels, that the ones that are designed specifically are different or do a little better.
Sure. Yeah, generally we fall down on the side of distinctive bodies and that kind of thing. The Fit is this cute little tiny car to begin with. It sort of looks like something that would naturally be electric, and so it's an obvious Fit for them to convert it. But they're definitely going to have to do some either graphics or colors or somehow styling cues to say this is an EV because the drivers definitely want it.
Hopefully not to the extent that the iMEV had their graphics on there with the big...
Well, I don't know. I thought the iMEV was kind of cute, but...
Well, when we both had an opportunity to drive the Japanese version, and it had this great two-tone colors with a stylized plug on the side, and people were going, are you selling electricity? Are you selling an extension cord?
Yeah, definitely. It was a little blunt, but...
Hey, we've got to take a moment here to thank one of our sponsors for tonight's show, Chevrolet. And we're talking specifically about the Chevrolet Cruze because according to MSN Autos, it's the class of its class right now. It comes with a 6-speed manual transmission or 6-speed automatic, Pioneer Premium 9-speaker sound system, more passenger room than the Civic, the Corolla, or Focus, gets better highway manual transmission fuel economy than those cars. And we got to point out that's with the 138 horsepower, 1.8 liter Ecotec. And of course, the rating on that engine is 26 mpg highway, 36 mpg, or 26 city, 36 highway. And you can find more about that at Chevrolet.com/Cruze. And of course, Cruze is Cruze. What's your cost of ownership tell you about the Cruze at all?
Well, there's a handful of cars that are coming out there. And again, a big part of cost of ownership is obviously fuel utilization. And again, that's the one from Chevrolet that's banging over the 40 mile per gallon mark. And this is an interesting factor to, you know, as we look at alternative fuels and you say, oh my gosh, you're making the internal combustion engine now capable of 40 miles per gallon plus. That's, you know, certainly you can look at that without having to look to an alternative fuel train. I don't know. I have these broad numbers in my mind that if you're at 40 or above, you're probably part of the solution. You know, and again, EV is way certainly way above that. 30 to 40, you're kind of neutral, but you know, you're at the point where below 30, you're kind of part of the problem, and below 20, you're a big part of the problem.
Well, it depends on what.
I know everybody drives different cars.
What that purpose is?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. If it's 200 miles an hour, some people might cut you some slack, right?
I don't want to say that. And also, you know, the whole thing is if you're driving something that's 10 miles a gallon, you got 10 people in the car as opposed to something driving 30 miles per gallon with only one person in all day. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can measure that. But it's great technology and. I happen to work with, I'm part of the Motor Trend Auto Group, and you know, we're all, you know, enthusiasts and things like that, but the people that are really fighting the alternative fuel stuff, you know, it's almost like, hey, time out. You know, if every car sold today was electric, it would still be 20 or 30 years before it took over all the cars on the road. I mean, it's just not going to happen that quick. We're going to have internal combustion.
In fact, before the big economic collapse, it would take this country 20 years to completely turn over its fleet. Now I see from the Polk data, people are holding on to their cars for 9 years, the longest it's ever been in history. So I'm guessing maybe that 20-year flip over of the fleet is probably 25 to 30 right now. So you're right. If we came up with the brilliant, absolute solution right now today, it'd be 20 or 30 years before everyone had one.
And that's if you sold all of the cars in that form. And that's the other thing. Again, we're still talking about a relatively small percentage of the vehicles sold today are alternative fuels.
Well, and especially looking at the production numbers. I mean, the most ambitious automaker out there is looking at 20,000 units next year electric. I mean, it's great for us compared to where we came from, but in terms of actually making a mark in the fleet,
it's going to take a while.
It's still not a mass car like an Accord or a, you know, you do have the hybrids in there as a percentage, but again, they're what, 10, 15% of the mix right now?
Hybrids?
Almost?
Not even.
2%.
Single digits.
Yeah.
3%.
In their out class. Of all the Camrys they sell, what's the take rate on the hybrids?
The
Camry is probably
the
very
big number
low.
Maybe hits 10.
Right.
So.
Right.
But to your point, I mean, of overall, it's at
no. But too. There still are a lot of them there. I think that and we had a discussion last night about this, that if gas stays where it is right now, I think hybrids win. Because and electrics, because that is kind of a fashion statement. You're saying, I really care about the environment, and I, you know, you're buying it for the same reason a guy buys a Lamborghini, you know, because they want it. They may not be able. I may not be able to drive it 200 miles an hour, but it's really a cool car, and I want to have it. Same thing with an electric or a Volt. You know, there'll be a lot of these early adopters, and it's cool technology. It's really neat stuff. Now, if gas went to like $5 or $6 a gallon, that's when I see like diesels becoming a bigger player in the market, because there is better range, there is better fuel economy,
and great drivability.
Yeah,
with the turbo diesels.
Right. So,
and we haven't even talked about those, and we really didn't see any of shown.
Because
this is the LA show, and everybody wanted to talk electric.
Right.
They didn't want to talk diesel unless you brought it up. But we were talking with Johan Denijsen from Audi, for example,
and he's a big diesel fan.
Big diesel fan, mm-hmm. And they have it on what, the A3 and the Q5, right?
Well, the last two green cars of the year were diesels.
Right. But when you look at the take rate on that, they're well over 25%. I mean, so the take rate on diesel where it's available is higher than the take rate on hybrid where it's available.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting.
Well, they're fewer, and I think the people who will buy that will seek them out.
Mm-hmm. They are. There's a very strong community of diesel owners.
Yeah, we had a TDI buyers. Long-term car, and I'm a Jetta.
They're awesome.
We were getting 43 miles per gallon.
Right. And see, the problem right now is that, as you guys know, U.S. emission standards are far stricter than they are in Europe, especially when it comes to NOx. And that's what drives up the cost of emissionizing, if there is such a word, the diesel.
There is now.
Boy, I just invented something. But I got to believe, give it 5 years, 6 years, companies like Bosch and Continental, you know, the supplier, they're going to figure out how to take the cost of that stuff down.
Right. Particulate was another, you know, with the filters that they have and then whether they...
But you know, to your point earlier, Charlie, when you were talking about gas engines getting like 40 miles per gallon, that's the thing, is that it's a moving target.
Right.
You know, both diesel, you know, and gasoline, they're only going to get better. So when they're coming up with these solutions, I think range is still going to be the absolute critical thing when it comes to pure electrics. And until they can figure a magic bullet to get an honest 300 miles out of a pure electric.
Right. And recharge them like a defibrillator. Bzap.
Well,
they had the 440.
They've been messing around with 440 and it takes like 5-10 minutes. You stop, get a cup
minutes.
Of coffee.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Nissan is saying 30 minutes for an 80% charge.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of variation depending on the size of the pack, but it's 20-30 minutes up to about 80%. You don't want to go to 100.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's certainly an option. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of interest in the other direction where people are sort of coming around, actually in the wake of things like the original Honda Fit and the subcompacts and Smart, to say, you know what, if we have more than one car in the family, not all of them has to do everything.
Right.
And a huge amount of interest in the $20,000 100-mile electric car as much or more than the $60,000 $50,000 300-mile electric car. Right. So I think we're going to see, for at least in the next several years, firmly in the economic space of bring the cost down of a basic commuter car and then worry about long-range stuff.
But, you know, the story I tell, coming back to your point about where it's a moving target, I was driving this summer, Hyundai Elantra, no, a Sonata, four people in the car going 70, 80 miles an hour, air conditioning on, and an indicated 40 miles to the gallon.
Yeah.
Now, this is a family sedan getting 40 miles. I think most Americans will go, that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Well, that's way better than some were, because a lot of the family sedans were around that. It's certainly below 30 and some close to the 20. And a lot of people, again, that were in minivans and SUVs that by design just don't get as good mileage, whether it's the profile or the four-wheel drive that's attached to them. So all of a sudden, it's a big step up for them.
Hey, back to the auto show and to Nissan. What did you make of the Murano convertible? I mean, this is the biggest damn convertible in the world right now.
It was funny because somebody said they saw people sitting in there and they looked like miniature people because this thing is so big. You stand up next to it and it's like, you
it's
know.
High. Oh, yeah, the belt line is huge
gigantic.
On that thing.
So I'm talking to somebody from Nissan who will remain unnamed, and he's like going, yeah, I started hating it. And people came back with positive comments. He said, starting liking it. And I said, okay, here's the arc of the Murano. You start out, you don't like it, you know, you're being honest, and then you get convinced, and then by the time you're ready to launch the car, it's the greatest car on the face of the planet. And then 4 years later, you'll go, what a piece of crap that Murano was. Remember that when we launched that car? I mean, that's how it works.
So it's the SSR for Nissan.
Yeah, it's just an answer to a question nobody really asked. I mean,
well, I think it's cool. I love to see automakers playing around with these different configurations. And I've been one who has said all along, I'd like to see a four-door convertible, because the Murano convertible is a two-door.
Right.
But, you know, when any automaker invests in a program, they got to hope that they're going to make a return on that investment. And I think Nissan's going to be seriously challenged to do that.
I think there are two big issues with it. One, it shouldn't be a crossover height. They should have dropped the ride height on the vehicle. And the second thing is they shouldn't have done it. And the one they should have done was the Juke.
Yeah.
That would have been a hot little convertible.
Yeah.
I
mean,
I think they're going to like the Juke.
Yeah, and I think they're going to probably find that the Murano will appeal to those people who did buy the PT Cruiser convertible, but that's about it.
Yeah. Well, I want to touch on something that's kind of a little bit encompassing that covers engines that we talked about, that talks about the domestics, and it was something that Ralph Jill said about they have a new V6. It's the Penstar 3.6 liter. And we're talking to him about, you know, what vehicles that might be in. And he made the statement, this is going to replace six different six-cylinder engines in the Dodge line alone.
Which is unreal.
I know. And so all of a sudden you start thinking, oh, my gosh, six engines that they were building in different places for different vehicles and the parts and the engineering. And just being able to focus the engineering effort on a single engine platform, that just was a remarkable statement at so many different levels.
Well, they learned from Nissan. I mean, because Nissan did that years ago with their 3.5-liter V6, which is a terrific engine. They threw it in just about everything. Now you get economy of scale. Now you can do all the fun stuff, which Chrysler hasn't gotten to yet. But I got to believe they're going to do variable valve timing, both intake and exhaust, direct injection, blah, 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 all the night, you know, all the
good
stuff.
A little bit with the transmission set up for power delivery. And it just seems that was just, to me, a more important statement than even the models that I'm looking at, that they're getting their act around just the whole manufacturing process and what it means to be a brand and your responsibility to, again, just the effort of your labor, that your engineers can focus on a single project.
Did you guys see the Impreza concept car from Subaru?
Yes, I like that. That was
I thought that was the best concept car out there. I was knocked out by it, and it looks very production ready.
Oh, yeah.
But very concept at the same time. So it was a little bit of a head turner as you went by.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I like is it adds crisp lines, something that Subaru really hasn't gone for, and a lot of good detail in the headlamps and taillights. Again, something that they haven't really played around with much. So I thought this was a big step up for Subaru, styling-wise.
Much the same way that Volvo, you know, with the S60, too, has moved the ball forward. And, you know, Subaru has a great reputation for building fun cars, but, you know, a lot of the fun and the visual excitement was tacked on stuff. And it was great to see this car where those elements were actually designed into the sheet metal rather than having a big wing stuck on the back or, you know, an aero kit.
Subaru and Volvo were always similar, where it was almost the heart of the car. They had the core group of people that were buying for, and the styling wasn't necessarily something they were known for. So it's nice to see them take a good styling stance.
Matt, I'm looking at, I've got my purple wrist band that they gave to everybody in the media going in, and you got some sort of teal thing.
That's the early entry band.
Early entry badge.
What, you get to go in?
I got to go in early. I had to do TV yesterday at 6 in the morning.
But
I got this after I got in. I actually walked in without a credential. Yeah.
Well, what
you
I
have,
love about the LA show...
wristband every now? Should we just, like, sit back while you guys work this out? Or
what? Well, the
here,
LA
wait,
show...
Wait, wait, this to you.
Wait. I think I can solve a problem here. Right. Let's just give him an early entry pass so he doesn't feel
Charlie's
bad.
Charlie's got one.
There you go. Never been worn. Yeah. Use it just yesterday and the day before. That's all you need to do.
Tack it up on the wall of my office.
There you go. Perfect. Always like to take care of the host.
What cracks me up about the L.A. show is to get into the show, you know, they search your baggage and you have to show photo ID and then they say, let's see your credential. You say, I don't have my credential. Oh, well, you have to go inside and get your credential. What kind of security is that?
For those of us that were just in Paris a month or so ago, way more difficult to get into L.A. than it was to get into the Paris show.
They give you a credential. You still have to have a wristband. It's like this whole double system.
Right. Yeah. And for your ID and everything. Volvo, we talked about, had an electric vehicle there.
Yeah, C30.
Did you drive it?
I didn't get to drive it. No, but I will. I'll just work my way up to Camarillo and do it there.
That got a design award of the logo to me. It was drive with the big E on it.
That car is good looking. It's definitely the talk of the EVs. It's the talk of the show.
C30's always been a good looking car. Oh. The only problem is nobody buys them.
IntelliChoice,
but it's a design
car
to sell as an EV.
So,
and that cute car, and they're saying, "Oh, well, we're not sure we want cute, you know, because we're trying to be edgy." I'm going, sure beats boring and boxy, doesn't it? And they're going, okay, yeah, it does. We'll take it.
Now, didn't the concept of that car have hub motors?
I'm not sure.
I thought they did. So. I seem to remember because they had it, I want to say, two Paris shows ago, maybe even three Paris shows ago, they had the concept of that vehicle.
You know, last time I was on your show, all we talked about was hub motors, so I'm not even going to bring that up at all. At all. I'm not going there.
We did talk a lot about those, didn't we?
That's common. Mitsubishi, Subaru, Volvo, they all start out with hub motors, and everyone's skittish of actually bringing them to market, and so by the time it actually gets production, it's no longer hub motors.
Hub motors, I think they're cool. I think they could do a lot, but it ain't ready for prime time just yet.
It scares the heck out of automakers. It's like massive regen, both of them. They want nothing to do with it.
But I like massive regen.
I know. Of course. Well, drivers like massive regen. You know, at least Tesla, Mini E gets to be a little strong for some people, but automakers just don't go there.
Is it an unsprung weight issue too?
Yes,
when you're
big time.
It out there?
Yeah. Because the guy that we had on from Protean, in fact, Bob Purcell, who used to be at General Motors, they've got maybe the most advanced hub motor that I'm aware of right now, but it's still like 70 pounds per wheel. Now, the offset is it's also 600 foot-pounds per wheel.
And
that makes up for a lot of sins of unsprung weight.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, I ran into Eric Ridenour, and he's at Unique Mobility now, which is what? In Colorado. It was originally started out to do hub motors. And I said, well, you guys still doing hub motors? He goes, no, we're doing traction motors. But basically, they provided a lot of the electric motors and that kind of stuff to GEM.
Yeah.
And through Chrysler.
And
Chrysler used to
own GEM. Well, Daimler Chrysler had it.
Right. But Unique Mobility was, and the guy.
And Eric Ridenour, you should point out, was what? Head of engineering at Chrysler?
Right.
Well, you bring up with GEM, and we can certainly talk about, was, at one point in California, a certain percentage of all of the vehicles the manufacturer sold, to sell cars in California, a certain percentage had to be zero emission.
Right.
And so GEM was one of the solutions. Think was one of the solutions for Ford, and they were essentially glorified golf carts, to lack of a
Well, that was one of the efforts to get out of building full performance EVs. You know, the Japanese automakers went to the state and said, if you give us a pass on this EV thing, we'll give you hybrids. The American automakers went to the state and said, if you give us a pass, we'll give you fuel cells and little neighborhood electric vehicles. And the state said yes to everybody, which is how we ended up with hybrids and why we're still sort of chasing fuel cells and those different things.
Exactly true. And this is probably a good point where we talk about our other sponsor on this show, which is Dow Betamate, which makes all kinds of structural adhesives. In fact, they're bonding glass to cars right now to add to the structure of the vehicle. They're literally bonding the roof to a vehicle, sheet metal to the structure. You can reduce all kinds of spot welds, which can make a car a whole lot lighter. And it also enables automakers to join dissimilar metals. Because, as you know, if you try to weld steel to aluminum, it just doesn't work. Or it might work for a short amount of time. It doesn't work in the long run. Same goes for magnesium. But if you can bond using structural adhesives, I'm trying not to say glue the car together here. I mean, that's essentially what they're doing. But as you guys know, in aerospace and military, they've been using structural adhesives for a long time. And, Matt, I'm sure you're well aware of using structural adhesives in cars too.
Well, there's a lot of developments going along with that. A lot of it has to do also with, the greater use of carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You're seeing bigger structures made of carbon fiber.
And you can't spot weld that. You
can't spot weld that. So, you know, it's a coming thing.
Let's not overlook the magazine itself is held together with adhesive.
Heck, the EV1 frame was epoxied together.
Yeah.
I've been playing with it for a while.
But Matt makes a great point because with EVs, I mean, BMW is going hog wild on carbon right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, aluminum and carbon. That's lightweighting.
You're going to have to bond that mm-hmm. stuff.
Yep, so. Absolutely.
DowBetaMate.com. Don't forget that. We love our sponsor.
And it gets to the point where the adhesion point is actually stronger than the
material around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But hey, now it's time to get to questions from you, our viewers. And so let's go in. Of course, this is what we call rapid fire,
okay.
Chelsea. And what we try to do is answer these questions really fast, not go on and opine and all that. But well, let's see.
good luck there.
007 Mitch W. says, what's the story on DC charging of EVs? If it only takes 30 minutes to charge in your house or at the mall or office, so what do you make with these DC chargers?
DC charging is the 480 we were talking about. Great on roadways, way too much power for home.
Yeah, you can't get these, unless you're like very, very wealthy, you're probably not going to get DC chargers
even
in your garage.
Even if the utilities will freak out at the idea of a transformer having to accommodate that.
But what about like in malls and other places like that? How easy is it to get that 440 volts in there?
It's the same thing. Still, even in a mall, 240 is kind of the sweet spot. I mean, it really is meant to be sort of someplace you'll only be for 20 minutes. You know, you spend a few hours at a mall, it's fine. So
where will we see 440?
Truck stops, roadways, those types of things.
Okay. You know. Real good.
Commercial settings.
Yeah.
This is a comment from Jeff W. He says, George Patton once said, don't tell people how to do things. Tell them what to do and let them surprise you with the results. Raise the gas tax, scrap CAFE, and let the market figure out the solution or combination of solutions to increase efficiency.
Amen.
Yeah.
Next.
Gas tax works. Works all the time.
Well, but we're all nodding, and none of us are elected officials. And
right,
unfortunately,
and they'll never do it. And to me, CAFE is trying to solve a retail problem at the wholesale level.
Exactly.
It's never going to happen.
What I've said all along is you can mandate that the car companies build fuel-efficient or alternative cars. You cannot force people to buy them.
Exactly.
You can't mandate that.
And that's the crazy thing. Just real quick, the attitude to the manufacturers, you know, they were fighting CAFE changes for so long, and it's not because they didn't want it, because they knew there wasn't necessarily a customer base for it. So,
Jim wants to know, does corn ethanol have a future if blending credits are cut from the federal budget?
No.
Okay, I think they do. I think corn ethanol is a stopgap until we get to cellulosic, and as I've always said, if America can make fuel out of garbage, we will rule the world.
And we can. We're actually doing better on making diesel out of garbage than ethanol from corn.
And again, a fuel tax of some sort on petroleum could make the ethanol or any of the alcohol-based fuels more economical. And mm-hmm.
But I keep pointing out, people are unaware of how much ethanol fuel we make right now.
Right.
It is
enormous.
In fact, that's why the EPA wants to raise the blend rate, because the cellulosic guys just can't get into the game right now. We are literally up to our eyeballs in ethanol mm-hmm. from corn, and they just can't get going. Anyway, for Ms. Sexton,
uh-oh.
What's it like to drive a car like the Volt that is so quiet? Do you shock people?
I shock people in all kinds of ways that have nothing to do with my driving.
Your driving? This is not what you're driving. Sorry.
Yeah. The Volt is one of the quietest EVs I have ever driven. it doesn't shock people any more than a Prius does. I mean, they're both quiet going through a parking lot, but there's tire noise and road noise, and they're not utterly silent. But it is a very cool Jetsons kind of feeling, and they're really smooth and no shifting, and it is a very different experience, but it's as emotionally compelling as, you know, a V8.
So what about, like, the noise that the Nissan Leaf is going to make? The Volt doesn't have anything
The Volt has the best solution of all, which is...
The horn.
No, actually, it's a carryover from EV1. There's a pedestrian alert on the Volt. It was the same as we had in EV1. You pull the lever forward when you want to make the noise, and it's an electronic chirp, flashes the lights.
It's like flashing the brights.
It's exactly what it's like.
You just pull the stop.
And it's perfect. It's noise when needed instead of noise all the time.
It's from the horn, but it's not a loud... It's like...
Right.
A half level
yep,
horn
it's
sound.
It's perfect. Drivers loved it.
And it's like a little stutter sound,
yeah.
too, like
yeah,
kind of
it's
thing.
It's exactly
right.
It.
Yep. For the IntelliChoice guy, do cars bought pre-owned, like BMW or Lexus, cost much more to own than new?
Not necessarily, but in other words, what you've done is you've mitigated the depreciation of the car, so your car is going to be worth closer to the same amount that you paid for it. But what happens when you buy the used cars, then sometimes you fall out of warranty, and then your maintenance and your repair costs go up, both as the car ages and then your responsibility to pay those. So it can vary by the vehicle. And again, you can mitigate that by having an extended warranty or buying a certified pre-owned vehicle.
Yeah, what about certified pre-owned? I hear they are the hottest things in the used car market right now,
They're
especially
really,
for luxury brands.
Really talking about it. And again, they support it. But as we've had our overall new car sales come down quite a bit over the last couple years, there isn't, you know, new car sales are the factory for used cars years from now. So there's fewer cars out there right now. We talk about a couple brands like a Subaru. You're hard-pressed to find a used Subaru on the market. John, what you mentioned on the luxury side, yes, because what they want to do is they want to make sure there's a lot of leases on the luxury side. So these cars do come back and they re-enter the market and then they become available. And the best way to buy those, again, for peace of mind, is to buy it as a certified pre-owned, because then you get some warranty carryover or extension when you buy it. And that, of course, will lower your cost of ownership.
For Matt DiLorenzo, what is R&T's internet strategy?
It's complicated.
The internet or your strategy?
It'd take a long time to explain that one. But
you're on the web.
We're on the web. We just launched with this show. We have an iPhone Auto Show app where we have the coverage from the show online. There's also information on how to get to the show, opening hours, that kind of stuff. And then we also archive previous show coverage from the web on the app. So if you've seen a car somewhere, you want to find out where it was introduced, it'll all, and it's a free app, so.
Free always works in my book.
Yep.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, is Fiat planning to do any electric models?
Electric 500.
Yes.
Coming in a few years, yeah.
Actually, they showed it at the Detroit show this year. Mm-hmm. Now, here's my question. Wasn't Chrysler supposed to be the guys who do all the electric stuff for both Fiat and Chrysler?
They did have their Envy program. Fiat shut that down pretty quick, so they ended up making one of each of those three cars and no more than that. So now it's the Fiat 500.
Say Cinquecento. It sounds so much better.
Shane says, Saab, their new models all look fantastic. Do you think these cars are going to be what they need to get their wings back?
Yeah, I think so. I was really impressed with the 9.5 because it has the character of a Saab. They did a really good job.
It's the best Saab in 20 years,
right,
is what I'm saying.
And you know what? If you go back in the previous generations of even some other great Saab cars, they shared platforms with
Opel
Fiat
and
Volvo. Was
Opel and didn't they?
Yeah.
Some of the French.
The 9000 was actually a shared platform between them and I think Peugeot. And Fiat. Because like Lancia Tema was actually a 9000 platform. So they've had experience in doing that kind of stuff. But I think it's great. I'd love to see them succeed. You know, Victor Mueller is really an interesting guy.
Isn't he?
And I wish him all the luck.
I do, too. I hope he can really pull it off.
It's a competitive area. There's lots of other cars that are available there that are very competent. But, vive la difference, and it's so neat that they're making fun cars and that are very competent.
Yeah. In a minute, let's bring in one of our phone calls. But first, Pedro asks, between the Cruze, the Focus, and the Elantra, quick prediction, who's going to sell more after 1 year?
So the new Elantra was introduced, 40-plus miles per gallon. So now all of a sudden we've got 40 and
Focus.
Rear.
Focus?
Because I think they're tooled up to build the most out of the three.
Mm-hmm. Really? More than Cruze? Cruise has what? The whole Lordstown plant.
But they have all of Wayne. And it'll be a race.
No, no. Oh, Focus. You know, Focus is Wayne. Yeah.
Yeah.
Elantra is split with Sonata.
Right.
So they've split that plant. So, yeah, that's pretty good. And so let's bring in a phone call here, Ben.
This is technology, people. Wait, there's a pause in the action here.
Hi, this is Derek V. from Plainfield, Illinois.
All right,
a quick two-part question for you. Are the vertical bars on the Buick and Lincoln grills too similar? Will they cause any kind of branding confusion or issue with the average untrained consumer's eye? And the second, do you see Lincoln positioning itself alongside Buick, Cadillac, in between or way above them, so more like in the BMW Mercedes level? Look forward to the comments and go Bears.
They're playing the Dolphins tonight.
We haven't even talked about the Giants winning the World Series yet.
So Buick and Lincoln grills, I don't think there's any danger in them looking too similar at all.
No.
Those cars,
no.
You know, if you took the grills out and put them on a board, maybe you'd say, oh, this. But you got to fit it in with the total view of the car,
right.
And I don't think there'll be any confusion.
Well, and they have the split grill in the Lincoln, the bow wave, which I'm not a big fan of, but it's more distinctive than the Buick. So you'll immediately identify the two brands.
But as far as where is Lincoln going to go, that's interesting because didn't spend a lot of time with Lincoln at this auto show. So that's maybe something we do in Detroit.
Yeah, but my personal belief is that it's going to be more of a competitor for Buick and not Cadillac because they haven't invested in, they're basically repurposing other platforms in the Ford line. And what they really need is a dedicated rear drive car platform if they're ever going to have a chance of competing with BMW or Mercedes. Cadillac.
Okay, and let's bring in another phone call now.
While we're waiting, would you like a chip?
I'm good, thanks.
This is wireless technology.
Hey, Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New Jersey.
All right, Jonathan.
I want to say thank you for the live coverage for the L.A. show. It was fabulous. It was better than being at the show myself because I got to hear you do all those interviews. It was really interesting, and the cars were great. Favorite interview was Bob Lutz.
Yep.
You got to get him on the show.
We will.
You got to talk to him about that book. I know he's pushing it and want to buy it. I'd love to hear about it and everything else he has to say as well. Thanks again. Great show. Ben looked good carrying that backpack from you live. And thank you so much. Have a good day.
Oh, thanks a lot, Jonathan. Yeah, Bob Lutz has got this book coming out where he really goes after this short-term quarterly fixation on earnings mentality that's taught in the MBA schools, and I could not agree more with him.
Sign me up for that.
Yeah.
And my first realization of that when I got to visit Japan one time and just had conversations with their long-term view, and I'm going, oh my gosh, this is just different. And it's not just the auto industry, so we don't have to
right.
pick on them,
yeah,
but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
just it's overall, you know, Wall Street in terms of, again, quarterly assessment.
Okay. Legislative Geek wants to know, John and crew, as the GOP, Daryl Issa, begins to attack Lisa Jackson's budget at the EPA, what impact do you think this is going to have on the automotive industry? He says, note, this could mean cutting back on energy loans, too. Well, you know, we did an AutoLine Detroit series on this where we brought in Nolan Finley and Edward Lapham from Automotive News and Finley from the Detroit News talking about all this. And that was their read, is that if the Obama administration sees that it's losing politically in Congress, it's going to go the regulatory route. And one of the speculations was maybe Congress will cut funding to the EPA so it just can't carry these things out. Hard to say where that's going to go. Boy, you know, we could sit here and throw darts at the dartboard and see where it lands.
Well, and it also depends on what CARB decides it wants to do in its next round of legislative. You know, all of our political energy has shifted from California to Washington with respect to anything efficient or alternative. And if CARB decides they want to wrestle that back, they may end up taking back whatever the EPA loses.
I think there's a couple of things.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things that have happened. Even if things have changed in Washington, in terms of the CARB here. You had Jerry Brown being elected governor. You have a Democratic legislature. CARB is going to do, and then you had the defeat of the rollback of AB 32, which is the greenhouse gas bill.
Yeah.
So it depends on how hard CARB wants to hit carbon, tax and carbon credits and that whole thing,
right.
and what impact if we'll end up with a de facto, California dictating the fuel economy standards for the rest of the country.
Right. Yep. Right. It should be pointed out that, 18 other states follow what California does. So
right.
California's legislation ends up affecting literally half the car buying market. It's not just a California thing.
Exactly right. Great point. George from Brooklyn wants to know, how long does GM's IPO stay this high? Because I think the stock has jumped some 30% plus from the IPO price.
And you're pointing out, this is the day. I mean, we're talking on the day that the stock hit the market. So
that,
what opened?
They not only rang the bell, but they had the horn sound of a Camaro SS going. So I thought that was a clever marketing step.
Right.
Oh, sure.
And we were all a little bit, we're out here in L.A. We kind of wish that there was a little more attention out here. But, hey, get on with the business at hand.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see where GM stock price goes. I mean, it's jumped a lot. You'd think some people will now say, hey, time to take some profit. So there's going to be some ups and downs. But if GM keeps racking up big profit numbers like it's done lately, the stock could go higher.
Yeah, go back to what you said right in the beginning, that these domestics are learning to make some money on lower volume. They start putting out cars. The Volt, we keep talking about, it's not a huge volume car, but it's kind of a halo car.
Yeah,
to the extent that, if we see some success there, then it transcends throughout the brands.
Well, not only that, but and I think this is going to happen with the Leaf, too, for Nissan. It's going to bring a lot of people into the showroom, and they're going to go, wow, that's so cool, but gulp. I can't afford the $350 a month lease payment, so I'll get a Cruise instead.
Right.
So
right.
It's going to do a lot for showroom traffic.
Well, and what it does beyond that is it convinces the world, one way or the other, whether GM is the new GM. Is it a company worth believing in again, which will be directly reflected in the stock price?
Great point. And they're going to have to prove it to the world that it is a new GM.
Exactly.
Not just temporarily.
Yeah.
So,
thanks, Chip.
Cosbert wants to know, do you think the Chevy announcement at Indy had anything to do with Lotus coming to Indy, or is it just a coincidence?
It's not a coincidence, because Indy has been talking about these rule changes for some time, and they went out courting manufacturers. They wanted to have competition among engine manufacturers. They went to Europe and talked to VW and all sorts of people. So two things happened. I think Chevy really wanted to get back in, and I think it's a great thing. But the Lotus deal, I think, is a turnkey deal with Cosworth. So it's not going to Lotus will be able to project itself much larger with that, but they don't have to do the engineering or the engine build.
So, cool. So not a coincidence.
No, it's not a coincidence. I mean, Indy wanted to get more people involved and more manufacturers involved, more, they're even talking to Boeing to do, like, aero kits and stuff. There would be a lot of latitude in the type of aero kits that you can throw on the car. So I think what they want to do is bring back the spirit of innovation rather than just being a spec racing series.
Let's take another phone call here. And the electrons are wafting across the airwaves as we wait.
I see them. They're magical.
Do-de-do-de-do-do.
Good to see you in Los Angeles. This is Youngblood in Cleveland, Ohio calling.
All right, Youngblood.
Show me your tan line, John.
Doesn't exist.
I get about 15 monthly publications, and I'd just like to congratulate Matt DiLorenzo that Road and Track is the best one that I get out of all 15. If they're all on a stack, that's the one that's always worn out after reading it about 5 times.
Well, thanks.
Okay, on to my question. I had a guest, and they were comparing the power density of batteries versus fossil. And if I believe right, the difference was 100 times, that the potential was 100 times greater in fossil fuel than battery potential. I hope that's right. But it has me concerned. Why are all these people so hopped up on electric cars when the main piece of the puzzle, the battery, is this inefficient? I don't understand why they aren't putting more money into developing a battery and getting the whole picture together. I realize they have the motors and the software and stuff like that, but the heart's missing. It'd be like buying a brand new Corvette with the 5-horsepower Briggs & Stratton engine. It just doesn't make sense until the whole picture's put together. That's all I have. I hope that would kind of get the panel talking about it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Enjoy the sun. We're not having it here in Cleveland.
Thanks, Youngblood. And he's got a good memory because we had Don Runkle on the show, and you guys probably know him.
Yep.
And that was one of the points he made, is that the energy density in a gallon of gasoline is 100 times greater than the best battery technology we have now. Any thoughts on what he said there, Chelsea?
Yeah, there's no question that gasoline is more energy dense. Does that mean that there's not a market for the current technology of batteries? No. Yeah, of course we're trying to make energy density better in batteries, costs come down in batteries, and part of that is facilitated by production. So we got to start somewhere.
And let me just add, again, this is all changing. And the important thing you said, as batteries now.
Right.
The difference is the energy potential is set in terms of a gallon of gas. But, you know, again, if we take batteries, they have improved. They're not there yet.
No.
But they're continuing to improve. I think we're all hoping for that transistor or that silicon chip that we're able to, you know, really leapfrog some technology. And until we try, we'll never get there.
Okay, and we've got another call coming in. And, Ben, let's start.
Hi, this is Jim from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Sioux Falls.
Two questions. One, whatever happened for Smart? For two, it seems to me that car should be able to get 50 to 60 miles per gallon, and it just hasn't panned out. And two, other than Autoline, Detroit.tv, what are a couple of good websites if a person is interested in battery-powered cars and they want to stay right on the cutting edge of what's going on? Appreciate the show, and thanks a lot. Bye.
What other websites are good for anybody who wants to know about batteries and electric cars?
Well, pluginamerica.org, very good website. And then just today, the Electric Drive Transportation Association launched their own website as well for consumer-facing information that is compiled by all of the automakers together. So not favoring one or the other, and they all agree on the data.
And say that name again, just so...
Electric Drive Transportation Association.
Okay.
The smart car was the question?
Yeah, smart for two. Why doesn't it get way better fuel economy than
well,
it does?
Well, again, smart, you know, I think that the real story on smart was really more of its size than its performance. And it really, you know, was the urban car, and it did so well in the European cities where it could actually, you know, park between the trees in Paris and things like that. So, unfortunately, it hasn't really been a leader in terms of if you talk about either alternative fuel or good fuel economy, even for that matter.
I have one at home.
A smart for two?
Yeah, mm-hmm. 45 easy.
45 miles to the gallon?
Yeah.
Really? Because
yeah.
It's rated at, what, like 35, isn't it?
I don't think it's quite that low rating, but we've had it for a couple of years, bomb up and down the state, and it
yeah,
does pretty
but
well.
It's more of a point of view thing, so it's great to hear that it's out there, but it seems like point of view are all about urban settings and just being able to scoot around.
I think
around.
That's it.
Sure.
The parking issue and the size,
right.
The footprint of the car, because... Even if you're getting 45, again, in a Jetta TDI, you can get 43.
Right.
You know, it isn't this 60-mile-per-gallon car. It's more, and then even the Honda Fit and those cars are
well.
Almost, yeah. You know, the same and almost the same price. So, you know, do you want to put two people in there or four people in there?
Yeah, although $12,000 as a starting price is pretty compelling to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But it hasn't worked. I mean, it just they can't give these things away.
You know, and I think that's another issue, too, is in terms of a vehicle like that, once a person has that vehicle, and if they use it as a city car, they're not going to put a lot of miles on that thing. So there isn't sort of that planned obsolescence, you know. Nobody's going to be putting 50, 60,000 miles a year on these cars. They're going to put like 10. So they'll keep the life cycle or the in your family, that's a car you'll keep 10, 12 years rather than, you know, 3 or 4 years, I'm tired of this thing, I want to get another one.
Well, look, we've gone an hour here, and time to wrap up the show. But Matt DiLorenzo from Road and Track, Chelsea Sexton, the advocate, Charlie Vogelheim, the executive editor of IntelliChoice, great having you all here on the
show. I've
got
nowhere else to go. Can we stay?
Well, this has been excellent. And, of course, we have to thank our sponsors, Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, get used to more, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. And Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com. And we have to thank LiveView for enabling this whole webcast to come to you. Literally just a satellite truck
in a
built
backpack.
Within a backpack. And It's just been terrific to have this kind of technology made available so that we can sit outside here, the beautiful Sofitel in Los Angeles, and enjoy a California evening that is just delightful. And I say that because I'm going to get on the plane tomorrow and fly back to Michigan where it's cold and rainy. But I love my home, so I don't mind going back there. That Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
He sat way too upright for De Lorenzo. I think there should have been a little bit more of this.
I got this pillow back there.